Disc 9.
Now I go shopping, I said. I did not slow down as I talked, but in fact was getting more frantic, because I knew I was getting closer to reconstructing what Carrie or her accomplice or someone had done. What do you mean, shopping? Through the wall I could hear the muffled bangs of test fires in the range. Why don't you check on Lucy, I said, and I'll get back to both of you later.
I don't like it when you do this later shit, Marino said, as elevator doors parted. That means you're running around on your own and poking your nose in things and maybe you shouldn't. And this ain't the time for you to be out on the street with nobody around. We got not a clue where Carrie is.
That's right, we don't, I said. But I'm hoping that's going to change. We got out on the first floor and I headed with purpose to the door leading to the bay, where I unlocked my car. Marino looked so frustrated I thought he might launch into a tantrum.
You want to tell me where the hell you're going? He demanded at the top of his voice.
A sports store, I said, cranking the engine. The biggest one I can find. That turned out to be Jumbo Sports, south of the James, very close to the neighborhood where Marino lived, which was the only reason I was aware of the store, since prowling for basketballs, frisbees, free weights, and golf clubs rarely entered my mind. I took the Powhite Expressway and two toll booths later was exiting on Midlothian Turnpike, heading toward downtown. The sports store was big and built of red brick, with stick figures of red-painted athletes framed in white on the outside walls. The parking lot was unexpectedly full for this time of day, and I wondered how many well-toned people spent their lunch hours here. I had no idea where anything was and had to take a few moments to study the signs above miles of rows. Boxing gloves were on sale, and there were exercise machines capable of tortures I did not know. Racks of clothes for every sport were endless and in blazing colors, and I wondered what had happened to civilized white, which was still what I wore on the much-appreciated occasion I found time to play tennis. I deduced that knives would be with camping and hunting gear, a generous area against the back wall. There were bows and arrows, targets, tents, canoes, mess kits, and camouflage, and at this hour I was the only woman who seemed interested. At first, no one was inclined to wait on me as I patiently hovered over a showcase of knives. A sunburnt man was looking for a BB gun for his son's 10th birthday, while an older man in a white suit was inquiring about snakebite kits and mosquito repellent. When my patience was no more, I interrupted. "Excuse me," I said. The clerk, who was college age, didn't seem to hear me at first.
"Thing is, you should check with your doctor before using a snakebite kit," the clerk was saying to the elderly man in white. "How the hell am I supposed to do that when I'm out in the middle of the woods somewhere and some copperheads just bit me?"
"I meant check with him before you go out in the woods, sir." As I listened to their backward logic, I could stand it no longer. "Snakebite kits are not only useless, but they're harmful," I said. "Tourniquets and local incisions sucking out the venom and all that just make matters worse. If you get bitten," I said to the man in white, "what you need to do is immobilize that part of your body and avoid damaging first aid and get to a hospital." The two men were startled.
"So there's no point in taking anything along?" the man in white asked me. "No point in buying anything, you're saying?"
"Nothing but a good pair of boots and a walking stick you can poke around with," I replied. "Stay out of tall grass and don't stick your hands into hollows or holes. Since venom is transported through the body by the lymphatic system, broad compression bandages like an ACE bandage are good, and a splint to keep the limb absolutely immobilized."
"You some kind of doctor?" the clerk asked.
"I've dealt with snake bites before." I didn't add that in those instances the victims had not lived. "I'm just wondering if you have knife sharpeners here," I said to the clerk.
"Kitchen sharpeners or ones for camping?"
"Let's start with camping," I said. He pointed to a wall where a vast variety of whetstones and other types of sharpeners hung from pegs. Some were metal, others ceramic. All of the brands were proprietary enough not to reveal the composition on the packages. I scanned some more, my eyes stopping on a small package on the bottom row. Beneath clear plastic was a simple rectangular block of grayish silver metal.
It was called a fire starter and was made of magnesium. Excitement mounted as I read the instructions. To start a fire, one simply needed to scrape a knife on the surface of the magnesium and build a pile of shavings as small as the size of a quarter. Matches weren't necessary, for the fire starter included a sparking insert for ignition. I hurried back through the store with half a dozen of the magnesium starters in hand, and in my haste got tangled up in one section, then another. I wound through bowling balls and shoes and baseball gloves, and ended up in swimming, where I was instantly captivated by a display of neon-colored swimming caps. One of them was hot pink. I thought of the residue found in Claire Rawley's hair. I had believed from the start that she had been wearing something on her head when she was murdered, or at least when the fire reached her. A shower cap had been considered but briefly, for its thin plastic material wouldn't have lasted 5 seconds in the heat. What had never entered my mind was a swimming cap, and as I quickly riffled through racks of them, I discovered that all were made of lycra or latex or silicone. The pink one was silicone, which I knew would hold up in extreme temperatures far better than the others. I purchased several of them. I drove back to my office and was lucky I didn't get a ticket because I was passing people no matter the lane. Images seized my mind, and they were too painful and horrific to entertain. This was one time I hoped my theory was wrong. I was speeding back to the labs because I had to know. "Oh, Benton," I muttered as if he were near me. "Please don't let this be so." 20. It was 1:30 when I parked inside the bay again and got out of my car. I walked quickly to the elevator and keyed myself back up to the third floor. I was looking for Jerry Garman, who had examined the pink residue in the beginning and reported to me that it was silicone. Ducking into doorways, I located her inside a room housing the latest instrumentation used in analyzing organic substances, ranging from heroin to paint binders. She was using a syringe to inject a sample into a heated chamber of the gas chromatograph and did not notice me until I spoke. "Jerry," I said, and I was out of breath. "I hate to disturb you, but I've got something I think you'll want to look at." I held up the pink swimming cap. Her reaction was completely blank. "Silicone," I said. Her eyes lit up. "Wow! A swimming cap? Boy, howdy. Who would have thought that?" she said. "Just goes to show you, there's too much to keep up with these days." "Can we burn it?" I asked. "This has got to run for a while anyway. Come on, now you've got me curious too." The actual trace evidence labs, where evidence was processed before it was routed through complicated instruments such as the SEM and mass spectrometer, was spacious, but already running out of room. Scores of airtight aluminum paint cans used in the collection of fire debris and flammable residues were in pyramids on shelves, and there were big jars of granular blue dryerite and petri dishes, beakers, charcoal tubes, and the usual brown paper bags of evidence. The test I had in mind was easy and quick. The muffle furnace was in a corner and looked rather much like a small beige ceramic crematorium, the size of a hotel minibar, to be exact, that could heat up to as much as 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. She turned it on, and a gauge very soon began registering its warming up. Jerry placed the cap inside a white porcelain dish not so different from a cereal bowl and opened a drawer to get out a thick asbestos glove that would protect her up to her elbow. She stood poised with tongs while the temperature crept to 100 degrees. At 250, she checked on our cap. It wasn't the least bit affected. "I can tell you right now that at this temperature, latex and lycra would be smoking up a storm and beginning to melt," Jerry let me know. "But this stuff's not even getting tacky yet, and the color hasn't changed." The silicone cap did not begin to smoke until 500 degrees. At 750, it was turning gray at the edges. It was getting tacky and beginning to melt. At not quite 1,000 degrees, it was flaming, and Jerry had to find a thicker glove. "This is amazing," Jerry said. "Guess we can see why silicone's used for insulation." I marveled, too. "Better stand back. Don't worry." I moved far out of harm's way as she pulled the bowl forward with tongs and carried our flaming experiment in her asbestos-covered hand. The exposure to fresh air fueled the fire more, and by the time she had placed it under a chemical hood and turned on the exhaust, the outer surface of the cap was blazing out of control, forcing Jerry to cover it with a lid. Eventually, flames were suffocated and she took off the lid to see what was left. My heart thudded as I noted papery white ash and areas of spared silicone that were still visibly pink. The swimming cap had not turned gooey or become a liquid at all. It simply had disintegrated until either cooling temperatures or an absence of oxygen, or perhaps even a dousing with water, had thwarted the process. The end result of our experiment was completely consistent with what I had recovered from Claire Rawley's long blonde hair. The image of her body in the bathtub, a pink swimming cap on her head, was ghastly, and its implication was almost more than I could comprehend. When the bathroom had gone to flash over, the shower door had caved in. Sections of glass and the sides of the tub had protected the body as flames shot up from the point of origin, engaging the ceiling. The temperature in the tub had never climbed above 1,000 degrees, and a small telltale part of the silicone swimming cap had been preserved for the simple freakish reason that the shower door was old and made of a single thick sheet of solid glass. As I drove home, rush hour traffic hemmed me in and seemed more aggressive the greater my hurry. Several times I almost reached for the phone, desperate to call Benton and tell him what I had discovered. Then I saw water and debris in the back corner of a burned-out grocery store in Philadelphia. I saw what was left of a stainless steel watch I had given to him for Christmas. I saw what was left of him. I imagined the wire that had confined his ankles and handcuffs that had been locked with a key. I now knew what had happened and why. Benton had been killed like the others, but this time it was for spite, for revenge, to satisfy Carrie's diabolical lust to make him her trophy. Tears blinded me as I pulled into my driveway. I ran, primitive sounds welling up in me as I slammed the front door behind me. Lucy emerged from the kitchen. She was dressed in khaki range pants and a black T-shirt and holding a bottle of salad dressing. "Aunt Kay," she exclaimed, hurrying to me. "What is it, Aunt Kay? Where's Marino? My God, is he all right?" "It's not Marino," I chokily said. She slipped an arm around me and helped me to the couch in my great room. "Benton," I said. "Like the others," I moaned. "Like Claire Rawley. A swim cap to keep her hair out of the way. The bathtub. Like surgery."
"What?"
Lucy was dazed.
"They wanted her face."
I sprang up from the couch.
"Don't you understand?" I yelled at her. "The nicks to bone at the temple, at the jaw, like a scalping, only worse. He doesn't build fires to disguise homicide. He burns everything because he doesn't want us to know what he's done to them. He steals their beauty, everything beautiful about them, by removing their faces."
Lucy's lips were parted in shock. Then she stuttered,
"But Carrie? Now she's doing that?"
"Oh, no," I said. "Not entirely." I was pacing and wringing my hands.
"It's like Galt," I said.
"She likes to watch. Maybe she helps. Maybe she fucked things up with Kelly Shepherd. Or maybe Kelly simply resisted her because Carrie was a woman. Then there was a fight, the slashing and stabbing, until Carrie's partner intervened and finally cut Kelly's throat, which is where the magnesium shavings were found. From his knife, not Carrie's. He's the torch, the fire builder, not Carrie. And he didn't take Kelly's face because it had been cut, ruined, during the struggle."
"You don't think they did that to...
Lucy started to say, her fists clenched in her lap.
"To Benton?"
I raised my voice more.
"Do I think they took his face, too?"
I kicked the paneled wall and leaned against it. Inside, I went still, and my mind felt dark and dead. "Carrie knew he could imagine everything she might do to him," I said in a slow, low voice. "She would have enjoyed every minute of it as he sat there, shackled, as she taunted him with the knife. Yes, I think they did that to him, too. In fact, I know it." The last thought was almost impossible to complete. "I just hope he was already dead," I said.
"He would have been, Aunt Kay."
Lucy was crying, too, as she came to me and wrapped her arms around my neck.
They wouldn't have taken the chance that someone might hear him scream, she said.
Within the hour, I passed on news of the latest developments to Tian McGovern, and she agreed that it was critical for us to find out who Carrie's partner was, if possible, and how she might have met him. McGovern was more angered than she would show when I explained what I suspected and knew. Kirby might be our only hope, and she concurred that in my professional position I had a better chance of making that visit successfully than did she. She was law enforcement. I was a physician. Border Patrol had ferried a Bell Jet Ranger to Hilo Air near Richmond International Airport, and Lucy wanted to take off this minute and fly through the night. I had told her this was out of the question, if for no other reason than once we got to New York we had no place to stay, and certainly we couldn't sleep on Ward's Island. I needed a chance first thing in the morning to alert Kirby that we were coming. It would not be a request, but a statement of fact. Marino thought he should accompany us, but I would not hear of it. No cops, I told him when he dropped by my house at almost 10 in the evening.
You're out of your friggin' mind, he said.
Would you blame me if I were?
He stared down at worn-out running shoes that had never been given a chance to perform their primary function in this world.
Lucy's law enforcement, he said.
As far as they're concerned, she's my pilot.
Huh.
I have to do this my way, Marino.
Gee, Doc, I don't know what to say. I don't know how you can deal with any of this.
His face was deeply flushed, and when he looked up at me, his eyes were bloodshot and filled with pain.
I want to go because I want to find those motherfuckers, he said. They set him up. You know that, don't you? The Bureau's got a record that some guy called Tuesday afternoon at 3:14. Said he had a tip about the Shepherd case that he'd only give to Benton Wesley. They gave the usual song and dance that sure everybody says the same thing. They're special. Got to talk to the man direct. But this informant had the goods. He said, and I quote, "Tell him it's about some weirdo woman I saw at Lehigh County Hospital. She was sitting one table away from Kelly Shepherd."
Damn, I exclaimed, as rage thundered in my temples.
So, as best we know, Benton calls the number this asshole left. Turns out to be a payphone near the grocery that got burned, he went on. My guess is Benton met up with the guy, Carrie's psycho partner, has no idea who he's talking to until, boom, I jumped. Benton's got a gun, maybe a knife to his throat. They cuff him, double locking with the key. And why do that? Because he's law enforcement and knows that your average Joe don't know about double locking. Usually all cops do is click shut the jaws of the cuff when they're hauling somebody in. The prisoner squirms, the cuffs tighten, and if he manages to get a hairpin or something similar up there to override the ratchets, then he might even spring himself free. But with double locking, no way. Can't get out without a key or something exactly like a key. It's something Benton would have known about when it was happening to him. A big bad signal that he was dealing with someone who knew what the shit he was doing.
I've heard enough, I said to Marino. Go home, please.
I had the beginning of a migraine. I could always tell when my entire neck and head began to hurt and my stomach felt queasy. I walked Marino to the door. I knew I had wounded him. He was loaded with pain and had no place to shoot because he did not know how to show what he felt. I wasn't even sure he knew what he felt.
He ain't gone, you know, he said as I opened the door. I don't believe it. I didn't see it, and I don't believe it.
They will be sending him home soon, I said, as cicadas sawed in the dark and moths swarmed in the glow of the lamp over my porch. Benton is dead, I said with surprising strength. Don't take away from him by not accepting his death.
He's gonna show up one of these days, Marino's voice was at a higher pitch. You wait! I know that son of a bitch. He don't go down this easy.
But Benton had gone down this easy. It was so often like that. Versace walking home from buying coffee and magazines, or Lady Diana not wearing her seatbelt. I shut the door after Marino drove away. I set the alarm, which by now was a reflex that sometimes got me into trouble, when I forgot I had armed my house and opened a slider. Lucy was stretched out on the couch watching the Arts and Entertainment Network in the great room, the lights out. I sat next to her and put my hand on her shoulder. We did not speak as a documentary about gangsters in the early days of Las Vegas played on. I stroked her hair, and her skin felt feverish. I wondered what was going on inside that mind of hers. I worried greatly about it, too. Lucy's thoughts were different. They were distinctly her own, and not to be interpreted by any Rosetta Stone of psychotherapy or intuition. But this much I had learned about her from the beginning of her life. What she didn't say mattered most, and Lucy wasn't talking about Janet anymore. "Let's go to bed so we can get an early start, Madam Pilot," I said. "I think I'll just sleep in here." She pointed the remote control and turned down the volume. "In your clothes?" She shrugged. "If we can get to Hilo Air around 9, I'll call Kirby from there." "What if they say don't come?" my niece asked. "I'll tell them I'm on my way. New York City is Republican at the moment. If need be, I'll get my friend Senator Lord involved, and he'll get the health commissioner and mayor on the warpath, and I don't think Kirby will want that. Easier to let us land, don't you think? They don't have any ground-to-air missiles there, do they?" "Yes, they're called Patience," I said, and it was the first time we had laughed in days. Why I slept as well as I did, I could not explain, but when my alarm clock went off at 6 a.m., I turned over in bed. I realized I had not gotten up once since shortly before midnight, and this hinted of a cure, of a renewing that I desperately needed. Depression was a veil I could almost see through, and I was beginning to feel hope. I was doing what Benton would expect me to do, not to avenge his murder, really, for he would not have wanted that. His wish would have been to prevent harm to Marino, Lucy, or me. He would have wanted me to protect other lives I did not know, other unwitting individuals who worked in hospitals or as models and had been sentenced to a terrible death in the split second it took for a monster to notice them with evil eyes burning with envy. Lucy went running as the sun was coming up, and although it unnerved me for her to be out alone, I knew she had a pistol in her butt pack, and neither of us could let our lives stop because of Carrie. It seemed she had such an advantage. If we went on as usual, we might die. If we aborted our lives because of fear, we still died, only in a way that was worse, really. "I'm assuming everything was quiet out there," I said, when Lucy returned to the house and found me in the kitchen. I set coffee on the kitchen table where Lucy was seated. Sweat was rolling down her shoulders and face, and I tossed her a dish towel. She took off her shoes and socks, and I was slammed with an image of Benton sitting there doing the same thing. He always hung around the kitchen for a while after running. He liked to cool down, to visit with me before he took a shower, and buttoned himself up in his neat clothes and deep thoughts. "A couple people out walking their dogs in Windsor Farms," she said. "Not a sign of anybody in your neighborhood. I asked the guy at the guard gate if anything was going on, like any more taxi cabs or pizza deliveries showing up for you. Any weird phone calls or unexpected visitors trying to get in?" He said no. "Glad to hear it. That's chicken shit. I don't think she's the one who did that." "Then who?" I was surprised. "Hate to tell you, but there are other people out there who are none too fond of you. A large segment of the prison population. And people who aren't in prison, at least not yet. Like the Christian Scientists whose kid you did. You think it might occur to them to harass you? Like sending taxis, a construction dumpster, or calling the morgue early in the morning and hanging up on poor Chuck? That's all you need is a morgue assistant who's too spooked to be alone in your building anymore. Or worse, the guy quits. Chicken shit," she said again. "Petty, spiteful chicken shit generated by an ignorant little mind." None of this had ever occurred to me before. "Is he still getting the hang-ups?" she asked. She eyed me as she sipped her coffee, and through the window over the sink, the sun was a tangerine on a dusky blue horizon. "I'll find out," I said. I picked up the phone and dialed the number for the morgue. Chuck answered immediately. "Morgue?" he nervously said. It was not quite 7, and I suspected he was alone. "It's Dr. Scarpetta," I said. "Oh," he was relieved. "Good morning. Chuck, what about the hang-ups? You still getting them?" "Yes, ma'am." "Nothing said? Not even the sound of somebody breathing?" "Sometimes I think I hear traffic in the background, like maybe the person's at a payphone somewhere."
I've got an idea, okay? Next time it happens, I want you to say, "Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. Quinn." "What?" Chuck was baffled. "Just do it," I said, "and I have a hunch the calls will stop." Lucy was laughing when I hung up. "Touché," she said. 21. After breakfast, I wandered about in my bedroom and study, deliberating over what to bring on our trip. My aluminum briefcase would go, because it was habit to take it almost everywhere these days. I also packed an extra pair of slacks and a shirt and toiletries for overnight, and my Colt 38 went into my pocketbook. Although I was accustomed to carrying a gun, I had never even thought about taking one to New York, where doing so could land one in jail with no questions asked. When Lucy and I were in the car, I told her what I had done. "It's called situational ethics," she said. "I'd rather be arrested than dead." "That's the way I look at it," said I, who once had been a law-abiding citizen. Hilo Air was a helicopter charter service on the western edge of the Richmond Airport, where some of the area's Fortune 500 companies had their own terminals for corporate King Airs and Learjets and Sikorskys. The Bell Jet Ranger was in the hangar, and while Lucy went on to take care of that, I found a pilot inside who was kind enough to let me use the phone in his office. I dug around in my wallet for my AT&T calling card and dialed the number for Kirby Forensic Psychiatric Center's administrative offices. The director was a woman psychiatrist named Lydia Ensor, who was very leery when I got her on the line. I tried to explain to her in more detail who I was, but she interrupted. "I know exactly who you are," she said with a Midwestern tongue. "I'm completely aware of the current situation and will be as cooperative as I can. I'm not clear, however, on what your interest is, Dr. Scarpetta. You're the chief medical examiner of Virginia, correct?"
"Correct.
And a consulting forensic pathologist for ATF and the FBI." "And of course they've contacted me, too." She sounded genuinely perplexed. "So, are you looking for information that might pertain to one of your cases? To someone dead?"
"Dr. Ensor, I'm trying to link a number of cases right now," I replied. "I have reason to suspect that Carrie Grethen may be either indirectly or directly involved in all of them, and may have been involved even while she was at Kirby."
"Impossible!"
"Clearly, you don't know this woman," I firmly said. "I, on the other hand, have worked violent deaths caused by her for half of my career, beginning when she and Temple Galt were on a spree in Virginia, and finally in New York, where Galt was killed. And now this. Possibly five more murders. Maybe more."
"I know Miss Grethen's history all too well," Dr. Ensor said, and she wasn't hostile, but defensiveness had crept into her tone. "I can assure you that Kirby handled her as we do all maximum security patients.
There's almost nothing useful in her psychiatric evaluations," I cut her off.
"How could you possibly know about her medical records?"
"Because I am part of the ATF National Response Team that is investigating these fire-related homicides." I measured my words. "And I work with the FBI, as I've already said. All of the cases we're talking about are my jurisdiction, because I'm a consultant for law enforcement at a federal level. But my duty is not to arrest anyone or smear an institution such as yours. My job is to bring justice to the dead and give as much peace as possible to those they left behind. To do that, I must answer questions. And most important, I am driven to do anything I can to prevent one more person from dying. Carrie will kill again. She may already have." The director was silent for a moment. I looked out the window and could see the dark blue helicopter on its pad being towed out onto the tarmac.
"Dr. Scarpetta, what would you like us to do?"
Dr. Ensor finally spoke, her voice tense and upset.
"Did Carrie have a social worker? Someone in legal aid? Anyone she really talked to?" I asked.
"Obviously, she spent a fair amount of time with a forensic psychologist, but he isn't on our staff. Mainly, he's there to evaluate and make recommendations to the court."
"Then she probably manipulated him," I said, as I watched Lucy climb up on the helicopter's skids and begin her pre-flight inspection.
Who else? Anyone she may have gotten close to?
Her lawyer, then.
Yes, legal aid.
If you would like to speak to her, that can be arranged.
I'm leaving the airport now, I said. We should be landing in approximately 3 hours. Do you have a helipad?
I don't remember anyone ever landing here. There are several parks nearby. I'll be happy to pick you up.
I don't think that will be necessary. My guess is we'll land close by.
I'll watch for you then, and take you to legal aid, or wherever it is you need to go.
I would like to see Carrie Grethen's ward, and where she spent her time, whatever you need.
You are very kind, I said.
Lucy was opening access panels to check fluid levels, wiring, and anything else that might be amiss before we took to the air. She was agile and sure of what she was doing, and when she climbed on top of the fuselage to inspect the main rotor, I wondered how many helicopter accidents happened on the ground. It wasn't until I had climbed up into the co-pilot's seat that I noticed the AR-15 assault rifle in a rack behind her head. And at the same time, I realized the controls on my side had not been taken out. Passengers were not entitled to have access to the collective and cyclic, and the anti-torque pedals were supposed to be cranked back far enough that the uninitiated did not accidentally push them with their feet.
"What's this?" I said to Lucy as I buckled my 4-point harness. "We've got a long flight."
She cracked the throttle several times to make certain there was no binding and it was closed.
"I realize that," I said.
"Cross-country's a good time to try your hand at it."
She lifted the collective and made big X's with the cyclic.
"Whose hand at what?" I said as my alarm grew.
"Your hand at flying, when all you got to do is hold your altitude and speed and keep her level."
"No way."
She pressed the starter and the engine began to whir.
"Yes, way."
The blades began to turn as the windy roar got louder.
"If you're going to fly with me,"
my niece, the pilot and certificated flight instructor, said above the noise, "then I'd like to know you could help out if there was a problem, okay?" I said nothing more. She rolled the throttle and raised the RPMs. She flipped switches and tested caution lights, then turned on the radio and we put our headsets on. Lucy lifted us off the platform as if gravity had quit. She turned us into the wind and moved forward with gathering speed until the helicopter seemed to soar on its own. We climbed above trees, the sun high in the east. When we were clear of the tower and the city, Lucy began lesson one. I already knew what most of the controls were and what they were for, but I had an extremely limited understanding of how they worked together. I did not know, for example, that when you raise the collective and increased power, the helicopter will yaw to the right, meaning you have to depress your left anti-torque pedal to counter the torque of the main rotor and keep the aircraft in trim. And as your altitude climbs, due to the pulling up on the collective, your speed decreases, meaning you have to push the cyclic forward. And so on. It was like playing the drums, as best I knew, only in this instance I had to watch for dim-witted birds, towers, antennas, and other aircraft. Lucy was very patient, and the time moved fast as we forged ahead at 110 knots. By the time we were north of Washington, I actually could keep the helicopter relatively steady while adjusting the directional gyro at the same time to keep it consistent with the compass. Our heading was 050 degrees, and although I could juggle not one more thing, such as the global positioning system or GPS, Lucy said I was doing a fine job keeping us on course. "We got a small plane at 3 o'clock, she said through her mic. "See it?"
"Yes."
"Then you say, tally-ho, and it's above horizon. You can tell that, right?"
"Tally-ho."
Lucy laughed.
"No, tally-ho does not mean 10-4. And if something's above horizon, that means it's also above us. That's important, because if both aircraft are at horizon and the one we're looking at also doesn't seem to be moving, then that means it's at our altitude and either heading away from us or straight for us. Kind of smart to pay attention and figure out which one, right?" Her instruction went on until the New York skyline was in view. Then I was to have nothing more to do with the controls. Lucy flew us low past the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, where my Italian ancestors had gathered long ago to begin with nothing in a new world of opportunity. The city gathered around us, and the buildings in the financial district were huge as we flew at 500 feet, the shadow of our helicopter moving below us along the water. It was a hot, clear day, and tour helicopters were making their rounds, while others carried executives who had everything but time. Lucy was busy with the radio, and approach control did not seem to want to acknowledge us because air traffic was so congested, and controllers were not very interested in aircraft flying at 700 feet. At this altitude in this city, the rules were see and avoid, and that was about it. We followed the East River over the Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Williamsburg bridges, moving at 90 knots over crawling garbage barges, fuel tankers, and circling white tour boats. As we passed by the crumbled buildings and old hospitals of Roosevelt Island, Lucy let LaGuardia know what we were doing. By now, Ward's Island was straight ahead. It was appropriate that the part of the river at the southwestern tip was called Hell Gate. What I knew about Ward's Island came from my enduring interest in medical history, and as was true of many of New York's islands in earlier times, it was a place of exile for prisoners, the diseased, and mentally ill. Ward's Island's past was particularly unhappy, as I recalled, for in the mid-1800s it had been a place of no heat or running water, where people with typhus were quarantined and Russian-Jewish refugees were warehoused. At the turn of the century, the city's lunatic asylum had been moved to the island. Certainly conditions were better here now, although the population was far more maniacal. Patients had air conditioning, lawyers, and hobbies. They had access to dental and medical care, psychotherapy, support groups, and organized sports. We entered the Class B airspace above Ward's Island in a deceptively civilized way, flying low over green parks shaded with trees as the ugly tan brick high-rises of the Manhattan Psychiatric and Children's Psychiatric Centers and Kirby loomed straight ahead. The Triborough Bridge Parkway ran through the middle of the island, where incongruous to all was a small circus going on, with bright striped tents, ponies, and performers on unicycles. The crowd was small, and I could see kids eating cotton candy, and I wondered why they weren't in school. A little farther north was a sewage disposal plant and the New York City Fire Department Training Academy, where a long ladder truck was practicing turns in a parking lot. The Forensic Psychiatric Center was 12 stories of steel mesh-covered windows, opaque glass, and air conditioning units. Sloppy coils of razor wire bent in over walkways and recreation areas to prevent an escape that Carrie apparently had found so easy. The river here was about a mile wide, rough and foreboding, the current swift, and I did not think it likely that anyone could swim across it. But there was a footbridge, as I had been told. It was painted the teal of oxidized copper and was maybe a mile south of Kirby. I told Lucy to fly over it, and from the air I saw people crossing it from both directions, moving in and out of the East River housing of Harlem. "I don't see how she could have gotten across that in broad daylight," I transmitted to Lucy. "Not without being seen by someone. But even if she could and did, what next? The police were going to be all over the place, especially on the other side of the bridge. And how did she get to Lehigh County?" Lucy was doing slow circles at 500 feet, the blades flapping loudly. There were remnants of a ferry that at one time must have allowed passage from East River Drive at 106th Street, and the ruins of a pier, which was now a pile of rotting creosote-treated wood jutting out into unfriendly waters from a small open field on Kirby's western side. The field looked suitable for landing, providing we stayed closer to the river than to the screened-in walkways and benches of the hospital. As Lucy began a high reconnaissance, I looked down at people on the ground. All were dressed in civilian clothes, some stretching or lying in the grass, others on benches or moving along walkways between rusting barrels of trash. Even from 500 feet, I recognized the slovenly, ill-fitting dress and odd gaits of those broken beyond repair. They stared up, transfixed, as we scoured the area for problems, such as power lines, guy wires, and soft, uneven ground. A low reconnaissance confirmed our landing was safe, and by now more people had emerged from buildings or were looking out windows and standing in doorways to see what was going on. "Maybe we should have tried one of the parks," I said. "I hope we don't start a riot." Lucy lowered into a 5-foot hover, weeds and tall grass thrashing violently. A pheasant and her brood were appropriately startled and darted along the bank and out of view amid rushes, and it was hard to imagine anything innocent and vulnerable living so close to disturbed humanity. I suddenly thought of Carrie's letter to me, of her odd listing of Kirby's address as One Pheasant Place. What was she telling me? That she had seen the pheasants too? If so, why did it matter? The helicopter softly settled and Lucy rolled the throttle to flight idle. It was a very long 2-minute wait to cut the engine. Blades turned as digital seconds did, and patients and hospital personnel stared. Some stood perfectly still, pinning us with glazed eyes, while others were oblivious, tugging on fences or walking with jerky motions and staring at the ground. An old man rolling a cigarette waved. A woman in curlers was muttering, and a young man wearing headphones started into a loose knee rhythm on the sidewalk, for our benefit, it seemed. Lucy rolled the throttle to idle cutoff and braked the main rotor, shutting us down. When the blades had fully stopped and we were climbing out, a woman emerged from the gathering crowd of the mentally deranged and those who took care of them. She was dressed in a smart herringbone suit, her jacket on despite the heat. Her dark hair was short and smartly styled. I knew before being told that she was Dr. Lydia Ensor, and she seemed to pick me out as well, for she shook my hand first, then Lucy's, as she introduced herself. "I must say, you've created a lot of excitement," she said with a slight smile. "And I apologize for that," I said. "Not to worry." "I'm staying with the helicopter," Lucy said. "You sure?" I asked. "I'm sure," she replied, looking around at the unnerving crowd. "Most of these are outpatients at the psychiatric center right over there," she pointed at another high-rise, "and Odyssey House." She nodded at a much smaller brick building beyond Kirby, where there appeared to be a garden and an eroded asphalt tennis court with a billowing torn net. "Drugs, drugs, and more drugs," she added. "They go in for counseling, and we've caught them rolling a joint on their way out." "I'll be right here," Lucy said. "Or I can head out to get fuel and then come back," she added to me. "I'd rather you wait," I said. Dr. Ensor and I began the brief walk to Kirby while eyes glared and poured out black, unspeakable pain and hate. A man with a matted beard shouted out to us that he wanted a ride, making gestures towards the heavens, flapping arms like a bird, jumping on one foot. Ravaged faces were in some other realms, or vacant, or filled with a bitter contempt that could only come from being on the inside looking out at people like us who were not enslaved to drugs or dementia. We were the privileged. We were the living. We were God to those who were helpless to do anything except destroy themselves and others. And at the end of the day, we went home. The entrance to Kirby Forensic Psychiatric Center was that of a typical state institution, with walls painted the same teal as the footbridge over the river. Dr. Ensor led me around a corner to a button on a wall, which she pressed. "Come to the intercom," an abrupt voice sounded like the Wizard of Oz. She moved on, needing no direction, and spoke through the intercom. "Dr. Ensor," she said.
"Yes, ma'am,"
the voice became human.
"Step on up."
The entrance into the heart of Kirby was typical for a penitentiary, with its airlock doors that never allowed two of them to be opened at the same time, and its posted warnings of prohibited items, such as firearms, explosives, ammunition, alcohol, or objects made of glass. No matter how adamant politicians, health workers, and the ACLU might be, this was not a hospital. Patients were inmates. They were violent offenders housed in a maximum security facility because they had raped and beaten. They had shot their families, burned up their mothers, disemboweled their neighbors, and dismembered their lovers. They were monsters who had become celebrities, like Robert Chambers of the yuppie murder fame, or Rakowitz, who had murdered and cooked his girlfriend and allegedly fed parts of her to street people, or Carrie Grethen, who was worse than any of them. The teal-painted barred door unlocked with an electronic click, and peace officers in blue uniforms were most courteous to Dr. Ensor, and also to me, since I clearly was her guest. Nonetheless, we were made to pass through a metal detector, and our pocketbooks were carefully gone through. I was embarrassed when reminded that one could enter with only enough medication for one dose, while I had enough Motrin, Imodium, Tums, and aspirin to take care of an entire ward.
"Ma'am, you must not be feeling good," one of the guards good-naturedly said.
"It accumulates," I said, grateful that I had locked my handgun in my briefcase, which was safely stored in the helicopter's baggage compartment.
"Well, I'm gonna have to hold on to it until you come out. It will be waiting right here for you, okay? So make sure you ask."
"Thank you," I said, as if he had just granted me a favor. We were allowed to pass through another door that was posted with the warning, "Keep hands off bars." Then we were in stark, colorless hallways, turning corners, passing closed doors where hearings were in session.
"You need to understand that legal aid attorneys are employed by the Legal Aid Society, which is a non-profit private organization under contract with New York City. Clearly, the personnel they have here are part of their criminal division. They are not on the Kirby staff."
She wanted to make sure I understood that.
"Although after a number of years here, they certainly may get chummy with my staff," she kept talking as we walked, our heels clicking over tile. "The lawyer in question who worked with Miss Grethen from the beginning will most likely arch her back at any questions you might ask."
She glanced over at me.
"I have no control over it," she said.
"I understand completely," I replied. "And if a public defender or legal aid attorney didn't arch his back when I appeared, I would think the planet had changed."
Mental hygiene legal aid was lost somewhere in the midst of Kirby, and I could only swear that it was on the first floor. The director opened a wooden door for me and then was showing me into a small office that was so overflowing with paper that hundreds of case files were stacked on the floor. The lawyer behind the desk was a disaster of frumpy clothing and wild, frizzy black hair. She was heavy, with ponderous breasts that could have benefited from a bra.
"Susan, this is Dr. K. Scarpetta, Chief Medical Examiner of Virginia," Dr. Ensor said. "Here about Carrie Grethen, as you know. And Dr. Scarpetta, this is Susan Blaustein."
"Right," said Ms. Blaustein, who was neither inclined to get up or shake my hand as she sifted through a thick legal brief.
"I'll leave the two of you, then. Susan, I trust you will show Dr. Scarpetta around. Otherwise, I will get someone on staff to do it,"
Dr. Ensor said, and I could tell by the way she looked at me that she knew I was in for the tour from hell.
"No problem."
The guardian angel of felons had a Brooklyn accent as coarse and tightly packed as a garbage barge.
"Have a seat," she said to me, as the director disappeared.
"When was Carrie remanded here?" I asked.
5 years ago."
She would not look up from her paperwork.
"You're aware of her history, of the homicide cases that have yet to go to trial in Virginia?" "You name it, I'm aware of it."
"Carrie escaped from here 11 days ago, on June 10th, I went on. "Has anyone figured out how that might have happened?"
Blaustein flipped a page and picked up a coffee cup. "She didn't show up for dinner. That's it," she replied. "I was as shocked as anyone when she disappeared."
"I bet you were," I said. She turned another page and had yet to give me her eyes. I'd had enough.
"Miss Blaustein," I said in a hard voice as I leaned against her desk, "with all due respect to your clients, would you like to hear about mine? Would you like to hear all about men, women, and children who were butchered by Carrie Grethen? A little boy abducted from a 7-Eleven where he'd been sent to buy his mother a can of mushroom soup. He's shot in the head, and areas of his flesh are removed to obliterate bite marks, his pitiful body clad only in undershorts, propped against a dumpster in a freezing rain."
"I told you I know about the cases." She continued to work.
"I suggest you put down that brief and pay attention to me," I warned. "I may be a forensic pathologist, but I'm also a lawyer, and your shenanigans get nowhere with me. You just so happen to represent a psychopath who, as we speak, is on the outside murdering people. Don't let me find out at the end of the day that you had information that might have spared even one life."
She gave me eyes, cold and arrogant,
because her only power in life was to defend losers and jerk around people like me.
"Let me just refresh your memory," I went on. "Since your client has escaped from Kirby, it is believed she is either murdered or served as an accomplice to murder in two cases, happening within a matter of days of each other. Vicious homicides, in which an attempt was made to disguise them by fire. These were predated by other fire homicides, which we now believe are linked, yet in these earlier ones, your client was still incarcerated here."
Susan Blaustein was silent as she stared at me.
"Can you help me with this?"
"All of my conversations with Carrie are privileged. I'm sure you must know that," she remarked,
yet I could tell she was curious about what I was saying.
"Possible she was connecting with someone on the outside?" I went on. "And if so, how and who?"
"You tell me."
"Did she ever talk to you about Temple Galt?"
"Privileged."
"Then she did," I said. "Of course she did. How could she not? Did you know she wrote to me, Ms. Blaustein, asking me to come see her and bring her Galt's autopsy photos?" She said nothing, but her eyes were coming alive. "He was hit by a train in the Bowery, scattered along the tracks."
"Did you do his autopsy?" she asked.
"No."
"Then why would Carrie ask you for the photos, Dr. Scarpetta?"
"Because she knew I could get them. Carrie wanted to see them, blood and gore and all. This was less than a week before she escaped. I'm just wondering if you knew she was sending out letters like that. A clear indication, as far as I'm concerned, that she had premeditated all she was about to do next."
"No," Blaustein pointed her finger at me. "What she was thinking was how she was being framed to take the heat because the FBI couldn't find its damn way out of a paper bag and needed to hang all this on someone," she accused.
"I see you read the papers." Her face turned angry.
"I talked to Carrie for 5 years, she said. "She wasn't the one sleeping with the Bureau, right?"
"In a way, she was." I honestly thought of Lucy. "And quite frankly, Ms. Blaustein, I'm not here to change your opinion of your client. My purpose is to investigate a number of deaths and do what I can to prevent others." Carrie's legal aid attorney began shoving around paperwork again. "It seems to me that the reason Carrie had been here so long is that every time an evaluation of her mental status came up, you made sure it was clear that she had not regained competency," I went on. "Meaning she is also incompetent to stand trial, right? Meaning she is so mentally ill that she's not even aware of the charges against her. And yet she must have been somewhat aware of her situation, or how else could she have trumped up this whole business about the FBI framing her? Or was it you who trumped that up?"
"This meeting has just ended," Blaustein announced, and had she been a judge, she would have slammed down the gavel.
"Carrie's nothing but a malingerer," I said. "She played it up, manipulated. Let me guess. She was very depressed, couldn't remember anything when it was important, was probably on Ativan, which probably didn't put a dent in her. She clearly had the energy to write letters. And what other privileges might she have enjoyed? Telephone? Photocopying?"
"The patients have civil rights," Blaustein evenly said. "She was very quiet, played a lot of chess and spades. She liked to read. There were mitigating and aggravating circumstances at the time of the offenses, and she was not responsible for her actions. She was very remorseful."
"Carrie always was a great salesperson," I said. "Always a master at getting what she wanted. And she wanted to be here long enough to make her next move. And now she's made it." I opened my pocketbook and got out a copy of the letter Carrie had written to me. I dropped it in front of Blaustein. "Pay special attention to the return address at the top of it. 1 Pheasant Place, Kirby Women's Ward," I said. "Do you have any idea what she meant by that, or would you like me to hazard a guess?"
"I don't have a clue."
She was reading the letter, a perplexed expression on her face. "Possibly the 1 Place part is a play off 1 Hogan Place, or the address of the district attorney that eventually would have prosecuted her."
"I don't have a clue as to what was going through her mind."
"Let's talk about pheasants," I then said. "You have pheasants along the riverbank right outside your door."
"I haven't noticed."
I noticed because we landed in the field there. And that's right. You wouldn't have noticed unless you waded through half an acre of overgrown grass and weeds and went to the water's edge near the old pier. She said nothing, but I could tell she was getting unsettled. So my question is, how might Carrie or any of the inmates have known about the pheasants? Still, she was silent. You know very well why, don't you? I forced her. She stared at me. A maximum security patient should never have been in that field or even close to it, Ms. Blaustein. If you don't wish to talk to me about it, then I'll just let the police take it up with you, since Carrie's escape is rather much a priority for law enforcement these days. Indeed, I'm sure your fine mayor isn't happy about the continuing bad publicity Carrie brings to a city that has become famous for defeating crime. I don't know how Carrie knew, Ms. Blaustein finally said. This is the first I've ever heard of fucking pheasants. Maybe someone on the staff said something to her. Maybe one of the delivery people from the store. Someone from the outside, such as yourself, in other words.
What store?
The patient privilege programs allow them to earn credits or money for the store. Snacks, mostly. They get one delivery a week and they have to use their own money.
Where did Carrie get money?
Blaustein would not say. What day did her deliveries come? Depends. Usually early in the week, Monday, Tuesday. Late in the afternoon, usually. She escaped late in the afternoon on a Tuesday, I said. That's correct. Her eyes got harder. And what about the delivery person? I then asked. Has anybody bothered to see if he or she might have had anything to do with this? The delivery person was a he, Blaustein said with no emotion. No one has been able to locate him. He was a substitute for the usual person who apparently was out sick.
A substitute? Right. Carrie was interested in more than potato chips. My voice rose. Let me guess. The delivery people wear uniforms and drive a van. Carrie puts on a uniform and walks right out with her delivery man. Gets in the van and is out of here. Speculation. We don't know how she got out.
Oh, I think you do, Ms. Blaustein. And I'm wondering if you didn't help Carrie with money, too, since she was so special to you.
She got to her feet and pointed her finger at me again.
If you're accusing me of helping her escape... You helped her in one way or another.
I cut her off. I fought back tears as I thought of Carrie free on the streets, as I thought about Benton.
You monster, I said, and my eyes were hot on hers. I'd like you to spend just one day with the victims. Just one goddamn day. Putting your hands in their blood and touching their wounds. The innocent people the Carries of the world butcher for sport. I think there would be some people who would not be too happy to know about Carrie, her privileges and unaccounted source of income, I said. Others besides me.
We were interrupted by a knock on her door, and Dr. Ensor walked in.
I thought I might take you on your tour, she said to me. Susan seems busy. Are you finished up here?
She asked the legal aid attorney.
Quite. Very good, she said with a chilly smile.
I knew then that the director was perfectly clear on how much Susan Blaustein had abused power, trust, and common decency. In the end, Blaustein had manipulated the hospital as much as Carrie had. Thank you, I said to the director. I left, turning my back on Carrie's defender. May you rot in hell, I thought. I followed Dr. Ensor again, this time to a large stainless steel elevator that opened onto barren beige hallways, closed off with heavy red doors that required codes for entry. Everything was monitored by closed-circuit TV. Apparently, Carrie had enjoyed working in the pet program, which entailed daily visits to the 11th floor, where animals were kept in cages inside a small room with a view of razor wire. The menagerie was dimly lit and moist with the musky smells of animals and wood chips and the skittering of claws. There were parakeets, guinea pigs, and a Russian dwarf hamster. On a table was a box of rich soil thick with tender shoots.
We grow our own birdseed here,
Dr. Ensor explained. The patients are encouraged to raise and sell it. Of course, we're not talking mass production here. There is barely enough for our own birds, and as you can see by what's in some of the cages and on the floor, the patients tend to be fond of feeding their pets cheese puffs and potato chips.
Carrie was up here every day? I asked.
So I've been told, now that I've been looking into everything she did while she was here. She paused, looking around the cages as small animals with pink noses twitched and scratched. Obviously, I didn't know everything at the time. For example, coincidentally, during the 6 months Carrie supervised the pet program, we had an unusual number of fatalities and inexplicable escapes. A parakeet here, a hamster there. Patients would come in and find their wards in their cages, or a cage door open and a bird nowhere to be found. She walked back out into the hallway, her lips firmly pressed. It's too bad you weren't here on those occasions, she wryly said. Perhaps you could have told me what they were dying from, or who. There was another door down the hall, and this one opened onto a small, dimly lit room where there was one relatively modern computer and printer on a plain wooden table. I also noted a phone jack in the wall. A sense of foreshadowing darkened my thoughts even before Dr. Ensor spoke. This was perhaps where Carrie spent most of her free time, she said. As you no doubt know, she has an extensive background in computers. She was extremely good about encouraging other patients to learn, and the PC was her idea. She suggested we find donors of used equipment, and we now have one computer and printer on each floor. I walked over to the terminal and sat down in front of it. Hitting a key, I turned off the screensaver and looked at icons that told me what programs were available. When patients worked in here, I said, were they supervised? No. They were shown in and the door was shut and locked. An hour later, they were shown back to their ward. She grew thoughtful. I'd be the first to admit that I was impressed with how many of the patients have started learning word processing and, in some instances, spreadsheets. I went into America Online and was prompted for a username and password. The director watched what I was doing. They absolutely had no access to the internet, she said. How do we know that? The computers aren't hooked up to it. But they do have modems, I said, or at least this one does. It's simply not connecting because there's no telephone line plugged into the telephone jack. I pointed to the tiny receptacle in the wall, then turned around to face her. Any chance a telephone line might have disappeared from somewhere? I asked. Perhaps from one of the offices? Susan Blaustein's office, for example. The director glanced away, her face angry and distressed as she began to see what I was getting at. God, she muttered. Of course, she may have gotten that from the outside, perhaps from whoever delivered her snacks from the store. I don't know. The point is, there's a lot we don't know, Dr. Ensor. We don't know, for example, what the hell Carrie was really doing when she was in here. She could have been in and out of chat rooms, putting feelers out in personals, finding pen pals. I'm sure you've kept up with the news enough to know how many crimes are committed on the internet. Pedophilia, rape, homicide, child pornography. That's why this was closely supervised, she said. Or supposed to have been. Carrie could have planned her escape this way. And you say she started working with the computer how long ago?
About a year.
After a long run of ideal behavior.
Ideal behavior, I repeated.
I thought of the cases in Baltimore, Venice Beach, and more recently in Warrenton. I wondered if it were possible that Carrie might have met up with her accomplice through email, through a website or a chat room. Could it be that she committed computer crimes during her incarceration? Might she have been working behind the scenes, advising and encouraging a psychopath who stole human faces? Then she escaped, and from that point on her crimes were in person. Is there anyone who's been discharged from Kirby in the past year who was an arsonist, especially someone with a history of homicide? Anyone Carrie might have come to know? Perhaps someone in one of her classes? I asked, just to be sure. Dr. Ensor turned off the overhead light and we returned to the hall. No one comes to mind, she said. Not of the sort you're talking about. I will add that a peace officer was always present.
and male and female patients did not mix during recreational times. No, never. Men and women are completely segregated. Although I did not know for a fact that Carrie had a male accomplice, I suspected it, and I recalled what Benton had written in his notes at the end about a white male between the ages of 28 and 45. Peace officers, who were simply guards not wearing guns, might have ensured that order was maintained in the classrooms, but I doubted seriously they would have had any idea that Carrie was making contact on the Internet. We boarded the elevator again, this time getting on the third floor. The women's ward, Dr. Ensor explained. We have 26 female patients at the moment, out of 170 patients overall. That's the visitor's room. She pointed through glass at a spacious open area with comfortable chairs and televisions. No one was in there now. Did she ever have visitors? I asked as we kept walking. Not from the outside. Not once. Inspiring more sympathy for her, I suppose. She smiled bitterly.
This book is continued on Disc 10.